Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Ashley Thompson and Alice Bryant. Later, we bring you the latest in the American history series, Making of a Nation. But first, the Science Report with Brian Lynn.
Israeli researchers say they have created the world's first three-dimensional or 3D printed heart using a patient's own cells. The researchers from Tel Aviv University recently announced the experiment and showed off the new 3D printed heart. Their findings were published in the journal Advanced Science. They described the experiment as a major medical breakthrough. The lead researcher on the project was university professor Tal Devere. He said in a statement that it was the first time that human cells had been used with 3D printing technology to successfully create a whole heart. Devere added that the printed heart contains blood vessels which are needed to pump blood. Until recently, scientists working on medical methods combining biology and technology were only successful in 3D printing simple tissues without blood vessels, the research team said. The engineered heart introduced by the Israeli team was not big enough to be transplanted into a human. At this stage, our 3D heart is small, the size of a rabbit's heart, Devere explained. But larger human hearts require the same technology. The development marks a step forward for 3D printing in the medical field. The technology has already expanded into many industries and has been developed to produce devices like guns, cars, and homes. The researchers wrote that they took samples of fatty tissue from patients. This material was then used to develop ink for the 3D printing process. First, the researchers created patches of tissue from the patient's own cells. Later, they used that same process to create a small version of a whole heart. Devere says using the patient's own cells is important to reduce the risk that the body's system to fight infection will reject a transplanted organ. The goal, the researchers said, is to treat heart disease. The World Health Organization reports that heart disease is by far the leading cause of death worldwide. For patients with severe heart disease, a heart transplant is currently the main treatment available. The researchers hope their invention can help ease the demand for heart transplant donors. Devere says that the newly created heart represents great progress. However, more research and development is needed to produce a fully operating, transplantable organ. For example, he said the heart cells will need to fully form parts that can work together to effectively pump blood. One of the biggest challenges for the engineering team will be finding a way to create a human-sized heart. Devere said his team plans to transplant heart models designed for animals, possibly within the next year. He added that for human use, simpler organs will likely be produced before hearts. Maybe in 10 years, there will be organ printers in the finest hospitals around the world, Devere said. He added that he hopes such methods will be used routinely to produce organs in the future. In 2017, the Israeli Health Ministry formed a group to examine the issues related to the use of 3D printing technology in the medical field, Israel's newspaper Haaretz reported. One of the group's members was Samer Suryuji, who works at Galilee Medical Center in the coastal city of Nahariya. He told the newspaper that while 3D printing in medicine offers great promise, it can also present problems. There were also cases that ended up with complications, causing infection and harm to the patient, he said. This area requires regulation, with protocols and clear guidelines in place, he added. I'm Brian Lynn.
Dusty playground in southwest Nigeria, school children line up to return to their classrooms. Many of their faces have exact matches within the group. That is because an unusually large number of children in this part of Nigeria are identical twins. Sights like this can be seen everywhere in Igbo Ora. A sign even welcomes visitors to the twins' capital of the world. Twins are common in the Yoruba ethnic group found in this part of the country. A 1970s study by a British doctor found that about 50 sets of twins were born out of every 1,000 births in the country's southwest. That is one of the highest rates of twin births in the world. In Yoruba culture, twins are so common that they are traditionally given specific names. They are called either Taiwo or Kehinde, depending on whether they were born first or second. But even for Yoruba people, Igbo Ora is considered to be exceptional. Among the nearly 100 school children who gathered at the end of their break, 18 were twins. There are so many twins because of the okra leaf that we eat, said 15-year-old Kehinde Oyedepo, who is a twin. Many in the town believe this is the reason for the high twin birth rate. The leaves are used to make a hot meal that is popular in Igbo Ora. Others have pointed to the popularity of amala, a local food made from yams. One theory is that yams activate the production of a chemical agent that stimulates egg production in women. Ekujumi Olarinwaju is a doctor based in the Nigerian capital of Lagos, about 160 kilometers from Igbo Ora. Olarinwaju believes the cause must be something else, because the same kind of yam is eaten in many parts of the world, without the same results. He suggested the cause may be because the genes that often lead to twins have become highly concentrated in this area. But the women who sell okra leaves at a town market are quick to disagree with the doctor. They say how locals eat the leaves is critical. For example, a stew made from the okra leaves should be eaten immediately and never stored. Oyaniki Bamemore said she was living proof that diet helped explain the high number of twin births. She said, "Because I eat okra leaves a lot, I gave birth to 8 sets of twins." I'm Ashley Thompson.
The number of women working in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM, fields in South Africa has not been very large. But programs aimed at girls there are beginning to change that. TechnoGirl is one example. Over about 10 years, the program has worked to bring 11,000 high school girls into these areas of study known as the STEM fields. TechnoGirl began in 2004 through a partnership. UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Agency, the South Africa Department of Education, and UWESO Trust joined their efforts to develop TechnoGirl. Each year, the program places girls between the ages of 15 and 18 in more than 200 companies in South Africa. The girls must be doing exceptionally well in school to qualify. After they are chosen, the girls stay at the companies for a 3-year period and receive mentorship from STEM professionals. The mentors also keep in contact with them throughout their university studies. Raquel Sorota was a student in the program. She grew up in Johannesburg's Tembisa Township with very little opportunity. She now works as a risk manager at a top South African insurance company. So Rhoda was chosen for the program in 2009. Now, at age 24, she says it has changed her life.
So I think a lot of what I took from the program was how it exposed me to the world of engineering. So I think for the longest time, I never knew of how broad that world was and that I could have a place within that world, most importantly.
Staff Sitole leads the company UWESO Trust and is the founder of TechnoGirl. She said the goal is more than just creating a new crop of workers. It is about changing the world and who runs it, she said. And through the program, she aims to support gender equality in South Africa. For high school students Guguletu Zungu and Queen Makaile, the barriers are more than just lack of opportunity. Both have physical disabilities. They were born with rare genetic defects that have affected their appearance and health. Both were chosen to be in the program this year for their high marks in math and science. Zungu says the program led her to identify her dream career, forensics, and imagine possibilities beyond it.
I like investigating and solving mysteries, and it actually makes me believe that indeed nothing is impossible. You just have to think out of the box.
Makaile, who has struggled with hearing and vision problems because of her defect, says she now wants to become a journalist. She wants to show the world that her thoughts matter more than her looks. Since the program began, more than 5,000 young women have received scholarships to colleges and universities. For these girls, they say nothing will stand in their way. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On November 11th, 1918, a truce was signed ending the hostilities of World War I. The Central Powers, led by Germany, had lost. The Allies, led by Britain, France, and the United States, had won. The war lasted 4 years. It took the lives of 10 million people. It left much of Europe in ruins. It was described as the war to end all wars. Barbara Klein and Doug Johnson tell about President Woodrow Wilson and his part in events after the war.
The immediate task was to seek agreement on terms of a peace treaty. The Allies were filled with bitter anger. They demanded a treaty that would punish Germany severely. They wanted to make Germany weak by destroying its military and industry. And they wanted to ruin Germany's economy by making it pay all war damages. Germany, they said, must never go to war again. President Woodrow Wilson of the United States did not agree completely with the other allies. He wanted a peace treaty based on justice, not bitterness. He believed that would produce a lasting peace. President Wilson had led negotiations for a truce to end the hostilities of World War I. Now, he hoped to play a major part in negotiations for a peace treaty. To be effective, he needed the full support of the American people.
Americans had supported Wilson's policies through most of the war. They had accepted what was necessary to win. This meant higher taxes and shortages of goods. At the time, Americans seemed to forget party politics. Democrats and Republicans worked together. All that changed when it became clear the war was ending. Congressional elections were to be held in November 1918. President Wilson was a Democrat. He feared that Republicans might gain a majority of seats in Congress. If they did, his negotiating powers at a peace conference in Europe would be weakened. Wilson told the nation, "The return of a Republican majority to either House of Congress would be seen by foreign leaders as a rejection of my leadership."
Republicans protested. They charged that Wilson's appeal to voters was an insult to every Republican. One party leader said, "This is not the president's private war." The Republican campaign succeeded. The party won control of both the Senate and the House of Representatives. The congressional elections were a defeat for President Wilson, but he did not let the situation interfere with his plans for a peace conference. He and the other Allied leaders agreed to meet in Paris in January 1919.
In the weeks before the conference, Wilson chose members of his negotiating team. Everyone expected him to include one or more senators. After all, the Senate would vote to approve or reject the final peace treaty. Wilson refused. Instead, he chose several close advisors to go with him to Paris. Today, American history experts say Wilson's decision was a mistake. Failure to put senators on the negotiating team, they say, cost him valuable support later on. In early December, President Wilson sailed to France. The voyage across the Atlantic Ocean lasted 9 days. He arrived at the port of Brest on December 13th. Wilson felt very happy. 13, he said, was his lucky number.
French citizens stood along the railroad that carried him from Brest to Paris. They cheered as his train passed. In Paris, cannons were fired to announce his arrival, and a huge crowd welcomed him there. The people shouted his name over and over again. Wilson, Wilson, Wilson. The noise sounded like thunder. French Premier Georges Clemenceau commented on the event. He said, "I do not think there has been anything like it in the history of the world." People cheered President Wilson partly to thank America for sending its troops to help fight against Germany. But many French citizens and other Europeans also shared Wilson's desire to establish a new world of peace. They listened with hope as he made an emotional speech about a world in which everyone would reject hatred, a world in which everyone would join together to end war forever.
More than 25 nations that helped win the war sent representatives to the peace conference in Paris. All took part in the negotiations. However, the important decisions were made by the so-called Big Four: Prime Minister David Lloyd George of Britain, Premier Georges Clemenceau of France, Premier Vittorio Orlando of Italy, and President Woodrow Wilson of the United States. Wilson hoped the other Allied leaders would accept his plan for a new international organization. The organization would be called the League of Nations. Wilson believed the League could prevent future wars by deciding fair settlements of disputes between nations. He believed it would be the world's only hope for a lasting peace.
Most of the other representatives did not have Wilson's faith in the power of peace. Yet they supported his plan for the League of Nations. However, they considered it less important than completing a peace treaty with Germany, and they did not want to spend much time talking about it. They feared that negotiations on the League might delay the treaty and the rebuilding of Europe. Wilson was firm. He demanded that the peace treaty also establish the League. So he led a group at the conference that wrote a plan for the operation of the League. He gave the plan to the European leaders to consider. Then he returned to the United States for a brief visit.
President Wilson soon learned that opposition to the League of Nations existed on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. Many Americans opposed it strongly. Some Republican senators began criticizing it even before Wilson's ship reached the port of Boston. The senators said the plan failed to recognize America's long-term interests. They said it would take away too many powers from national governments. 37 senators signed a resolution saying the United States should reject the plan for the League of Nations. That was more than the number of votes needed to defeat a peace treaty to which Wilson hoped the League plan would be linked.
The Senate resolution hurt Wilson politically. It was a sign to the rest of the world that he did not have the full support of his people. But he returned to Paris anyway. He got more bad news when he arrived. Wilson's top advisor at the Paris Peace Conference was Colonel Edward House. Colonel House had continued negotiations while Wilson was back in the United States. House agreed with Wilson on most issues. Unlike Wilson, however, he believed the Allies' most urgent need was to reach agreement on a peace treaty with Germany. To do this, House was willing to make many more compromises than Wilson on details for the League of Nations.
Wilson was furious when he learned what House had done. He said, "Colonel House has given away everything I had won before I left Paris. He has compromised until nothing remains. Now, I have to start all over again. This time, it will be more difficult." For Woodrow Wilson, the most difficult negotiations still lay ahead.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.